seated, please. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. Matter before the court this morning, August 6, 2021, is Sepperth-Holzer LLP versus 4th Judicial District. The attorneys appearing for the petitioner in this special proceeding are Mr. John Janis over here. Yeah. And Mr. Janis will be arguing. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, Your
Honor. Kurt Holzer is appearing only today. Good morning. For the respondents, 4th Judicial District, Ms. Christine Salmi is present. Good morning, ma'am, along with Joseph Hurdle. Good morning. Each of you will have 7.5 minutes to argue for your individual respondent or intervener respondent, correct?
Sure.
Are there any preliminary matters prior to your arguments? Counsel, I guess given the current status, we'd ask you to remain masked since there's no plexiglass around the podium.
Please.
Yes, please. Without any other preliminary, then, sir, you may proceed.
And please, this honorable court, let me say at the outset as a petitioner that our law firm understands, appreciates, and very much respects the fact that the relief being sought here is extraordinary. And I understand totally that these types of petitions are reserved only for extraordinary situations. With respect to all, we submit that what happened here, the legal proceeding, the decisions, basically everything that happened that brings us before this court today, are themselves just incredibly extraordinary. We were disqualified after a year of representing the plaintiff in this lawsuit on the basis of the secret or in-camera submittals that we've never been allowed to see. And in the context of making the decision, what we were told about this in the court's decision, there were numerous serious, undeniable factual and legal errors that formed the basis of that decision. Hence the reason we're before this court. For example, a legally dispositive error that was like the kiss of death was reversing the burden of proof on the motion to disqualify, which has been made clear under Idaho law that, like all other motions, the burden is on the moving party. But instead, the court reversed it, put it on the non-moving party, and doing it under these circumstances where the decision is being based on trying to prove a negative, and that it's all proof submitted to the court private, it's not just a difficult burden to sustain, it's impossible for anyone. It's not even possible. Legally, the court in adopting the ethical rules makes clear, it goes to some length explaining how the ethical rules are not mandates for civil cases, they are for disciplinary procedures, and discussions ensue on the preamble about using them in a civil setting. They're not like in the disciplinary setting. But the court in this case basically said violation of the rules was mandate. That's the end of it. No further discussion. Supposed to be a discretionary decision, and she didn't do that.
Mr. Janis, you alluded to the professional rules, and I'm trying to understand the interplay between our decision making and the professional rules. And in that light, doesn't 1.19 comment 6 put the burden on you and your client to demonstrate that there hasn't been an exchange of confidential information with Mr. Laporta?
I think with respect, Your Honor, the answer to that question is no. We have several appellate decisions that have point blank said, and I can quote it, that the burden of proof on a motion for disqualification of adverse counsel is on the moving party. It's Weaver-Millard, and I might add, it was in the supplemental authorities that were submitted this week by the state, included the Judge Boyle decision, and he too said it was clear, quote unquote, that the burden in a motion to disqualify, on a motion to disqualify, is on the moving party. That's for a disciplinary procedure. That's for a procedure for someone's looking to be sanctioned by the bar. And in that context, and it's a clear convincing evidence standard too over there, but that's what that's for. It's not for this.
Have we said before that it's a clear and convincing standard?
I thought that was a clear and convincing standard before the bar. But I'm getting that from memory. I may not be right about that. Sorry if I am not.
Counsel, is it correct to look at this as a disciplinary sanction?
Certainly, I know in the Kosman case, which you cite in your brief, we discussed that this court typically allows the bar to address disciplinary matters. Is this a disciplinary matter, or is this just a basic ruling of a court about disqualification of counsel and not imposing a sanction, per se?
Well, certainly what happened to us, as far as we're concerned, the order was a sanction, and a severe one, and an unnecessary one. There's no complaint made to the bar, to my knowledge. So it's kind of hard to answer that question. It's in the civil context here, and we're just disqualified on the basis of making these rules like they're mandatory. And they're not, and there's errors all over the place. And so, I mean, obviously one of the points I wanted to make today was that the preamble and the case law on this is universal, and in cautioning against on motions to disqualify being construed with very strict scrutiny, because of the very real risk they'll be misused as a weapon. And that's probably the answer to the question. More likely that than it is an actual bar proceeding.
You've alluded that there was a tactical element to this. Would you like to develop that further for us?
I can't think of another good reason for this, frankly. I mean, like I said, what we had in the way of information was obviously limited. But I know I was the architect of that brief they're talking about here. And so I know in my mind where the arguments came from. Every one of them were responsive to something the judge said in the memorandum decision. A lot of us spent quite a bit of time intensely researching this and came up with those arguments. So to hear that's our new argument, quote unquote, is somehow traced back to an associate being made privy to that argument a year beforehand at the defense firm. I don't get it. It's not in my mind, it's nowhere near true. Like I said, I was the architect of the arguments in the briefs.
Is there a reason you haven't asked us to review the documents that Judge Norton considered on the in-camera submission?
I don't have a reason for that, but I don't have access to them. I'm the person they're keeping in front, or not the person that, at the party they're keeping in front. I don't have control over that. If they are willing to release them, it's fine by me. No objection at all.
It seems to me that one of the critical factual findings that Judge Norton made was that Mr. Laporta searched BBRA's file in support of arguments in Tubbs versus BBRA. You pointed out a number of factual errors on Judge Norton's part, but I didn't see any effort to address that specific factual conclusion.
It's my understanding, Judge Norton, that the court concluded that he accessed bogus files, not Tubbs' bogus files, but bogus files to get that 2014 brief that was filed in the Ada County case for Judge Moody. That was what we retrieved, and then she spent some time going through the facts saying that was confidential or secret. But I don't think there's any accusation that he's searching something in the Tubbs files. I don't think there's any evidence of that whatsoever. He never heard of me, Gary Tubbs, before this. So my understanding, that whole thing happened from basically a passing in the office weekend chat, what are you working on? Or releases, oh, and volunteering to do work on his own on that purpose, and that wound up getting the 2014 brief. From some source that admittedly is whatever is in the firm, I don't know how it works, but some of the archived brief bank or whatever, or somebody else gave it to him, I don't know, but it's in the Eulenburg problem, so to speak. But the point of all this, as far as we're concerned, is there's not going to be a problem with this unless there's a confidential thing being used. And there's no way this thing could be considered confidential. It's in the public record. It's unavailable on Westlaw. Everybody knows it's been available on Westlaw since May of 2015.
Counsel, one concern I have that I think may be important later on in our analysis is the status of your firm's relationship with Dr. Tubbs now. And given the gag order, I know that makes this quite murky, but is he still a client of your firm? Does he consider himself your client?
I have not been able, I've been ordered by the court not to speak with Dr. Tubbs. The last time I spoke with him was at that weird motion to clarify here. The judge instructed me to not talk to him other than give him the names of lawyers. That's the last time I spoke to him. And he wasn't a communication, just me saying that.
Do we have any way of knowing, and again, this is a difficult question, I understand, but do we have any way of knowing whether he still wants your firm to represent him in this case, given all the drama, frankly, that's taken place with the law firms?
Judge, I have sat and wondered what Gary probably thinks about all this stuff. Consider what's happened here. But all I can tell you in response to that, because I don't have any communications with Gary, because it would be a contempt of court, I understand. But I can tell you that we had a very, very good relationship. He was a client, and he was also a friend. And I think we came to like each other quite a bit. So I would strongly suspect that he would want us to continue working on this case. That's my answer.
Mr. Janus, is it your interpretation of the order that you cannot represent him on appeal, cannot file an appeal on his behalf?
Absolutely. That point was made absolutely crystal clear, that we could not represent Garrett for any purpose. We would have, of course, if we had been allowed to file a motion to reconsider, because as you can see from the briefs and the amount of mistakes made here, it would be worthy of pointing out to the court that this is everything factually upon which you're basing the decision is wrong. It's literally wrong, that demonstrably so. And the reversing of the burden of proof, that's a legal error, that's the kiss of death. That made no sense in that context. How can we respond to something that's submitted in secret?
So I mean, if Judge Norton reviewed that material in camera, and we're trying to gauge how she performed her duties, isn't it incumbent on us to look at the material that was submitted to her in camera?
I'm perfectly fine with reviewing those materials. But I don't control that. I've been told it's confidential from us, that we're being who it's being kept from. So if they want to read and submit that afterwards, that's fine by me. Because I almost don't care what it is, because it all boils down to a legal argument somehow being construed as confidential, which is very difficult to understand, which is application of law to fact, neither of which are confidential things. And how can the lawyer have some kind of proprietary, patent-like monopoly on a legal argument? That just makes no sense to me. But if there's a proceeding that anybody wants to follow that gets me materials to the court, I stipulate right here. But it still boils down to the factual basis of that decision, dead wrong. The legal basis of that decision, dead wrong. The reversing of the burden of proof in this context was absolutely fatal. And you can see just everywhere in the decision where it's being said, all inferences are assumed in their favor. You know, we talked about this notion of to be careful about it being used as weaponized ethical rules. Well, the concern there, the court in this case went the philosophical opposite direction of that. It gave every possible advantage to the moving party and every disadvantage to us, the non-moving party, like construing the burden of proof in favor of them, so that everything we said was essentially unimportant. Everything they said was essentially the truth, or all reasonable inferences thereupon. And again, the decision makes continual references to inferences in their favor. So, is this 12 minutes, or is it? So I have three more? Okay, I'll shut up then. Well, probably everybody doesn't want me to shut up, just use up my 3 minutes. So I think the point here is the errors of law. The court repeatedly uses the word mandate as if it's a mandate, so it takes away from the whole point of it being a discretionary decision, and which is contrary to what this court has adopted in the ethical rules. But there's a place where the court's kind of touchstone of the court's decision is that in review of the in-camera materials, that the argument we made in this motion to reconsider brief could only have come from the associate short amount of time dealing with it a year earlier, not even having no billable time at all. It's a gigantic fact because, as Judge Windmill says, if the associate's just on the periphery of the case, that's not a grounds to disqualify. Well, the lack of billable time is about a proof positive of that as you can get in a defense firm. But in any event, she said the only place that argument could possibly come from is from that particular source, which would suggest that it's not even possible that we can come up with the argument. I mean, how does that make any sense? I already know where the argument didn't come from now, but, you know, to read that is really, I think, a gigantic error. I'll sit down.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you all very much.
Ms. Salmi, when you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Justice Bevin. I please the court, counsel. My clients, who I will collectively refer as the district court, believe this petition for writ of mandate and prohibition should be denied for multiple reasons. One, lack of standing. Two, there's an adequate available remedy available, which is a direct appeal. Three, the discretionary nature of this disqualification decision
means it is immune from the special writ proceeding. And four, the record before this court is simply incomplete for this court to assess the merits of the disqualification order. I think we touched, I noticed the justices touched on it, and I'll talk more about it. And then finally, there's simply no proof of legal error in the disqualification order. So, lack of standing. There's no evidence in this record that the firm, and I'll refer to them as the firm, sustained any distinct injuries themselves. Instead, there are simply unsupported, unverified statements of a number of alleged injuries, majority of which are Dr. Tubbs, not the firm's. The only alleged injury the firm has alleged is certain financial injuries, and that relates to their inability to reap the benefits of their contingency fee agreement. However, the proximate cause of those financial injuries is the conflict of interest that the firm itself has created by failing to screen Mr. Laporta. It is not the disqualification order that came after the fact. Therefore, we don't have proximate cause to support those particular basis for standing.
Well, doesn't that argument, though, kind of beg the question? They don't think there is a conflict, so therefore their whole argument that they're out a contingent fee would be analyzed differently from that perspective. The only way we get to where you just stated is if we assume there was a conflict of interest, correct? If they can establish or if they can persuade us that there wasn't, then there is an injury by them being disqualified, isn't there?
The injury is caused by, well, obviously the conflict. And if there was no conflict, then there's no injury, and then there's no standing. I mean, this isn't the concept of whether they have standing to bring these special writ proceedings. And applying the simple, are there distinct injuries, and were those particularly caused by the alleged harm in this petition, which is the disqualification order?
But let's assume there isn't a conflict, and the judge has precluded the firm from pursuing the case and even speaking to the client. And if there is a contingent fee, and if, as Mr. Janis suggests, it's meritorious, and Dr. Tubbs, is unable to pursue an appeal, hasn't the firm sustained an injury?
Well, I would say the important element of your question, Your Honor, is that there's no evidence in this record that Dr. Tubbs, who is the real party in interest, is not able to challenge the disqualification order himself.
Well, wait a second. Hepworth Holzer is unable to talk to Dr. Tubbs. He doesn't even know what's going on as far
exactly.
as... Exactly. And you don't think that is an impediment to him pursuing an appeal?
There's nothing to stop Dr. Tubbs from being able to consult with new counsel to move forward or to proceed on his own. In fact,
and let's assume that the averment of Mr. Janis is correct, that it's very unlikely that Dr. Tubbs would be able to find counsel to engage in an appeal given the posture of this case.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I would say that's an assumption. There's simply just no evidence before this court that that is in fact the case.
Well, those of us who have practiced law would consider that an argument that would have merit.
If Dr. Tubbs retained new counsel, would the gag order prevent this firm from talking to the new lawyer?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me also move on, since my time is very limited. I appreciate the questions. I would submit that even if there is standing, there are multiple problems for why this petition should not move forward. And that's primarily because we do have an adequate available remedy in law. Dr. Tubbs can file a direct appeal. In fact, the procedural stance of this case is that it is ripe for appeal. A final judgment has been entered, and now they can move forward with a final appeal.
And how would that be speedy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well,
with the mask, I'm like, who's talking?
I'm sorry. How would that be speedy if Mr. Tubbs or Dr. Tubbs is allowed to take an appeal? It's going to take, I don't know, 18 months probably to get the appeal perfected, to get the briefing done, to have argument and have a decision. How is that speedy?
That's an ordinary remedy that's available to every party when they want to appeal an adverse decision. And the Idaho courts are very clear that writs of proceedings are extraordinary remedies that should not be in place of appeals. And in fact, we shouldn't even look at whether it's inconvenient to a party or not, because the appeal is the primary aspect that the court should consider on whether that's readily available to a party. And I would submit that that is the case here.
All of which is true, except there now appears to be an exception for a disqualification of counsel to the writ of mandate. Something that I frankly wasn't aware of until I started researching this case, that it appears to me that the courts have drawn a distinction for the writ of mandate where counsel has been disqualified. Isn't that precisely the case we have?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I haven't found that authority.
The Ninth Circuit says it. Well, why don't you go ahead and I'll find the case.
Okay. I would say I myself haven't found that authority, and I don't believe that the petitioners have cited any of those cases. In fact, the cases that are cited in the petitioner's briefing all show that it is the client that is pursuing the challenging the disqualification order. There's never a disqualified counsel. I have yet to see a case where a disqualified counsel has been allowed to pursue a writ of proceed mandamus.
So I'm quoting now from the Ninth Circuit, Cole versus the United States District Court for the District of Idaho, 366 Fed 3rd, 813. It's a 2004 case. The rule is that a writ of mandamus may be used to review the disqualification of counsel, citing Christensen versus the United States District Court.
And I would say Cole isn't controlling here because they are applying the federal writ statute, not the Idaho writ.
But isn't the principle the same, that the writ of mandamus, which is an extraordinary writ, should be available under these circumstances based on federal law? I'm not saying it's controlling. I agree it's not controlling. But it's an exception to the general rule of writ of mandate is not available under these circumstances.
Okay, I can't tell when I'm running out of time. I don't want to run into his time. And I want to answer your question.
I think you're out of time, but you may answer the question without treading on Mr. Fertel's time.
I certainly think that there could be a carve-out. I just haven't seen any precedent for it in my research, and I think there are multiple other reasons why this particular petition should be denied.
Have you had the opportunity to review Elam Burke's in-camera submission?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Have you reviewed Elam Burke's in-camera submission?
No, I have not had that opportunity, and I understand that you haven't either, so I'm not quite sure how you can address the merits of the DQ order, even if you find that it's proper to be here before the court.
So basically, you're in the same position as Mr. Janice. You have no idea whether that submission supported the district court's determination or not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whose responsibility would it be to present that in the record?
I would submit that that would be the petitioner's responsibility, since that they bear the burden. They could have asked, and we actually had an offer by the Elam Burke counsel to submit it to the court. It's not here, and therefore I think the record is incomplete for this court to provide the relief requested.
Even though the district judge made it clear that they were not to have any viewing whatsoever, including even the Mr. Laporta having the ability to look at an email that he generated. They couldn't even do that.
Your Honor, I think that this court could review the in-camera material to determine whether or not the merits of the disqualification order is proper. I think this court could, not Mr. Janice's firm.
But even though Mr. Janice's firm doesn't have the ability to do anything with respect to that order or the information that was submitted in camera, you think he could still ask this court to consider information that has been entirely denied to him?
I think, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think Mr. Janice could have made a motion before this court to make sure that this court had the complete record that it needed in order to provide the relief it's requesting.
Any additional questions from the court? No? Thank you very much, ma'am. Mr. Pirtle, when you're ready, sir. And I believe he has 7.5 minutes, Madam Clerk. Thank you.
Bevan, members of the court, Madam Clerk, counsel. I hope to speak about many of the issues that Ms. Salmi already addressed, so I think I will reserve my time for addressing why the petition fails to allege a valid basis for granting the extraordinary relief that they are requesting. And to touch upon Justice Mueller's question earlier about whether the gag order prevents counsel from speaking to new counsel, it does not. It allows the Hepworth-Holzer firm to speak to new counsel and to Dr. Tubbs about any matters up to but not past January 21st, 2021. So I wanted to clarify that.
Well, doesn't that take away the ability to discuss at all the disqualification?
It does, Your Honor. And I may point out for the record, there was a hearing in which Judge Norton did hear arguments which she deemed to be a motion to reconsider by the Hepworth-Holzer firm. Dr. Tubbs was at that hearing. He was permitted to get information and did get information from the court about the status of the case. And prior to that, I believe this is in the record, there was an order from Judge Norton instructing Hepworth-Holzer to send Dr. Tubbs a copy of her order and a letter explaining the status of the case. So this is not a circumstance where Dr. Tubbs has no idea whatsoever what is going on. And I don't know to what extent the motion to disqualify and the circumstances upon which it was based were communicated to Dr. Tubbs before the disqualification decision was issued. To the point being raised about the sealed briefing, and that it wasn't sealed, it was available to the public. There is no allegation in this case that Mr. LaPorta got that briefing from a public source. The district court found, and it was a correct determination, that that brief was found from Eilenberg's client files. And that, combined with the communications with Mr. Walters and me about the Tubbs case, the arguments we wish to make, that is all work product, that is all confidential information that should not be shared, which is why it was appropriate for us to have submitted this information in camera to Judge Norton for her to consider.
So the memorandum that Judge Norton concluded had been obtained from Eilenberg's files, she also concluded that it wasn't available on Westlaw. And do you suggest that that was a correct determination by her?
It turned out not to be, Your Honor. It apparently is available if a Westlaw user has an ability to do a more robust search than the search that Judge Norton had through her chambers.
You're not suggesting that something that's publicly available on Westlaw is work product, are you?
No. Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So the document that she relied on in making her determination was a publicly accessible document?
I don't know that it was. It could be accessed through Westlaw through special considerations. At least according to Judge Norton, it is not accessible through Ada County because when the files became digitized through the I-Corp transition, the paper files, which this would have been part of, were quote-unquote sealed. But that's a bit of a red herring because if Mr. LaPorta had obtained it from that source, that would be one thing, but he did not. The fact that he got it from Eilenberg's client files triggered the comment 6 to Rule 1.9 that Your Honor brought up earlier.
And Mr. Janis suggests that the burden of proof as set forth in comment 6 is for disciplinary proceedings, not for legal proceedings. Would you agree with that?
No, I would not. The comment certainly doesn't make that indication, Your Honor.
And would you say that Cosman versus Dinius sheds light on that analysis?
Not directly, Your Honor. I believe that case touched upon whether the rules a professional conduct can be a basis for triggering civil liability or a civil claim, and in that case, they were seeking some damages, I believe, in the way of penalties. We have not asked for that we are not asserting a claim. Bogus Basin definitely is not asserting a claim. The rules were utilized to establish the conflict that existed and the appropriate basis for disqualifying counsel.
Help me understand how your firm in some ways didn't, I don't want to say waive, but may have helped create this problem by not raising the issue sooner. If you had a partner in your firm that had worked on this case, and you knew that partner had went to another firm that was representing the other side in the case, why did you wait until the motion for reconsideration was filed to raise this issue?
We didn't, Your Honor. And that is part of Mr. Walter's affidavit that is submitted in camera. And so I don't know how appropriate it is. I'm happy to answer the question fully, but it's not part of the record.
Well, you can understand from the record before us why we would think you waited. And I know there's some allusion in your brief to the fact that there was something about the style and format that made you suspicious when you didn't know about this before. What was there about the style and format of the motion for reconsideration that tipped you off on something that you likely should have been aware of long before?
Well, we were not aware that Mr. Laporta was going to work on a case for Tubbs when he had assisted and worked on a case for Bogus Basin. That thought didn't cross my mind that would ever be possible. But to answer your question, Your Honor.
Wait. Why did you think that would never be possible?
Because the ethical rules are certainly clear enough to me that creates a conflict of interest. And even if it's close to the line of a conflict of interest, I would err on the side of caution and not work on that matter. I would screen that attorney, Your Honor, myself and screen myself.
So why not just a simple letter to the firm saying, hey, we wish our former associate best of luck with your firm. Make sure he doesn't work on this case, by the way.
Which is what it had happened with Mr. Laporta's move from Powers Farley to Elenberg. The firm he left.
In hindsight, Your Honor, we probably should have sent that letter. But it is not the burden of the firm from whom the attorney is exiting to raise a conflict issue. In this instance, it was Mr. Laporta and Hepworth Holzer's obligation under the rules to get informed consent from Bogus Basin in writing before he could work on a matter given the circumstances.
Well, we're talking about duties to clients. Didn't your duty to your client require that you provide such a notice?
Your Honor, I can say that the notice was provided to Mr. Laporta directly and that that's part of Mr. Walter's affidavit that was submitted in Canada to Judge Norton.
Which is conflict with Mr. Laporta's affidavit.
It is, Your Honor.
So how do we resolve that conflict?
Well, Judge Norton resolved it by weighing the credibility of the witnesses, but she had the benefit of the emails that were submitted in camera, which Your Honors do not have.
But the only thing that in the record before us is paragraph 76 of Mr. Laporta's affidavit, where he represents that Mr. Walter said that he wasn't going to require that he be screened from involvement in cases between the two firms.
And I can submit, Your Honor, that the record is incomplete. And we, as the intervener, our charge in this matter was limited to submitting a brief. We did ask, I believe, in two instances in our brief, if the court is inclined to obtain additional information from us, we're happy to submit it. We still stand by that and would submit those materials. But it would resolve the appearance in the record that there is only one side of this, Your Honor.
I've heard that. Sounds to me like the petitioners are being faulted for not asking for that to be submitted earlier, but certainly based upon the record before us, there's no rationale justifying the district court's decision. So why wasn't it incumbent upon you to explain the district court's decision by providing the record?
Your Honor, and it goes a bit to the circumstances in this case where the arguments that are being asserted is as if this was an appeal and it is not.
Right.
It is an extraordinary writ, and Idaho case law is very clear that the petition must assert sufficient facts to entitle the petitioner to the relief, and if it doesn't, it should be denied.
Right. Well, you've intervened because you know why what the judge did was right, and yet you haven't provided us any evidence of why what the judge did was right.
And I'll submit, Your Honor, that I read this court's order and what the intervener was allowed to do, that if I submitted those materials, I would be going beyond what I was allowed to do by And if this court is willing, I'm happy to request that the in-camera materials be submitted to the court, along with all the other information that was submitted to Judge Norton for consideration on the motion that the petitioner did not include with its submittals to this court.
But I take it you're not willing to go so far as to allow Hepworth-Holzer to review those documents.
I cannot, Your Honor, and it's to protect the confidentiality of the information that is client information.
Any other questions? Very well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time remains for petitioner?
2 minutes. Mr. Janis, before you get going, I want to ask if you have a response to what I understood to be Mr. Pirtle's request to augment the record with the in-camera submissions.
As I said, I'll stipulate to allow this court to review these materials, and had anybody called me ever and asked that, I would have said instantly, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's unfair about us not getting access to it, but nevertheless, that's what happened, and there's nothing I could do about it. But I'd be happy for this court to review the in-camera materials. I think part of that, in response to Judge Orton's points, is that we can't know whether it supports the judge's decision or not. Well, we do know a number of things that she has told us, like the facts upon which her decision was based that are just undeniably wrong. It's just you can't get around it. And again, the misapplication of the burden of proof. So I think we do know something about it. But also, on the subject of screening and all this other stuff, we did screen this whole thing. I mean, we can have it covered in our affidavits, and we're convinced by talking to Mr. LaPorta that there was no conflict here. He didn't work on this Tubbs case, as they're now trying to put it. Like I said, if you worked on the Tubbs case, there would be billable time. That's the way it works. And if there was anything not known, bear in mind, I know these guys for 30-plus years. I worked there. It's my first job. I have very big fondness for that firm and really close friends, so anything would have done to get this accomplished. I thought it was obvious there was no conflict, and all he was helping out doing research until it turned into this. So as far as the standing, I think we've made the real-world point. The idea that a contingency plaintiff who's a quadriplegic now and has no legal sophistication of any kind is just go find a new attorney to take over what's already a losing cause. And think of it, it's got to go to appeal first. At least, and if he wins it, there's a chance that Dr. Tubbs would hire us back and they'd be fired. It's an incredibly real-world difficulty to say they can get it. And to say they just go get one like willy-nilly is kind of callous. And as far as the standing issue goes, that's what we deal with. Every plaintiff's lawyer in the country would tell you this is an investment, is what it is. We put tons of man hours into this thing and out-of-pocket costs. And so it's a definite investment. And as far as the First Amendment thing, she's ordered us to not talk to anybody. I mean, it's an infringement on the free speech if I ever heard it. I know I'm going to run out of time, but I wanted to make this other point before. I should say, by the way, that the point about the Ninth Circuit case, that was going to be my ending point. That was my big rallying end of the argument.
Sorry to steal your thunder.
Stole my thunder a little bit. The other thing I want to say, though, is of importance, is that the judge kind of implying that there's like one new argument in this brief. That brief had lots of new arguments. Again, it was all responsive to the things she said in the summary judgment that we thought were wrong. So there's also a reference to one case cited in that that was part of this. Well, there's 24 cases cited. I've counted them in that motion to reconsider brief that had not been in any brief beforehand. So it's not as simple as what is being said here. And
Mr. Janis, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, we appreciate your time and consideration today. Normally, we'd come and shake your hands, but given this current circumstance, we'll simply wish you the best and say good job from here. And this matter will be taken under advisement. We will conference the matter immediately in terms of what to do about this request, if you will, stipulation for additional material. If that is agreed upon by the court, an order will issue that this matter won't come under advisement until those matters are received in some period thereafter to allow us to review the same. If that's not, the case will be immediately under advisement and opinion will issue. Any questions in that regard?
No, thank you.
Thank you. All right.